Up now is Jeff Katz with Split Season 1981, Fernando Mania, the Bronx Zoo, and the Strike That Saved Baseball. Jeff? Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. I know I've met some of you. I'm Jeff Katz. I'm the author of Split Season. I'm also the mayor of Cooperstown. Not the drunk at the end of the bar mayor of Cooperstown, but the actual duly elected mayor of Cooperstown. So, so whenever you come back to Cooperstown, give me a holler. On the night of June 10th, 1981, over 57,000 Phillies fans crammed into Veterans Stadium to see Pete Rose break Stan Musial's all-time NL hit record of 36-30. Rose had been signed by the Phillies after 1978, and his free agency and subsequent signing led to the first Phillies championship in their history. Phillies were facing the Astros that night, and Pete was facing Nolan Ryan, who had signed after the 1979 season as a free agent with the Astros for the now quaint figure of $1 million a year, but quite amazing back then. Rose singled in his first pitch in the first at-bat against Ryan. Crowd went crazy knowing that the record-breaking hit was right in front of them. But Ryan struck out Rose in the third and in the fifth and in the eighth, and that was it for the day. 3,631 very sad balloons were released over Veterans Stadium into the Philadelphia sky. And that was the end of the Phillies season, possibly, because on the next night at the Doral Hotel in New York, negotiations that had begun in 1979 between players and owners were about to come to a close. Ray Grebe, the owner's lead negotiator, asked Marvin Miller and the union, "Are you really going to strike?" They couldn't believe it. Where had he been for the last year and a half? Past midnight into June 12th, Miller came out, weary from the talks, saying, "We have met most of the day. We have accomplished nothing. The strike is on." A little while later, at about 1:45 in the morning, Commissioner Bowie Kuhn took a very long and sad walk back to his office. Someone noticed him and said, "Hey, Bowie, what's going on?" Bowie said, "They're out. They're out." And so began the first midseason strike in sports history. So how did we get there? In 1980, a strike was narrowly averted with only one issue left on the table. That was free agency compensation. Players had been granted free agency in December 1975 by an arbitrator's decision, and in the subsequent years, players and owners alike were shocked at the amount of money being thrown around in the game. And it's important always to keep in mind that players may be able to make demands, but players ultimately do not pay themselves. Owners write those checks. The owners then and now seemingly have a hard time controlling themselves. So what they tried to do was in effect make free agency a trade. They wanted something called direct compensation, meaning if a team lost a free agent, they would be able to pluck from the team's roster of the team that signed the free agent a quality major league player. The owners wanted to allow only 15 players to be frozen, allowing the team that lost the free agent to pick an amazing player starting at 16. Maybe that didn't matter when you were signing Pete Rose or Nolan Ryan or Dave Winfield, but not everyone was of that caliber. So the idea that you would sign a backup infielder and give up your third starter was absurd. The players saw it for what it was. It was a way to curtail movement. And consider this, you know, the players, it took until December 1975 to get the rights we all have, which is to work wherever we want to in our chosen field. Players were not going to pull back on that. And only in 1981, Reagan's first year of presidency, did trickle-down economics work in baseball. It's the only place trickle-down economics works. The top. Is it booing baseball or booing me for criticizing Reagan? I'm not sure.
It works.
It works.
The only thing that works is trickle-down economics.
Okay. That'll be next year's presentation. So what happened was the top salary guys led to a complete effect on the salary structure through arbitration, through negotiations, things like that. So the settlement was reached in 1980 with only compensation left on the table. The first step was a joint study committee. What had been agreed upon was a process. The owners would be able to implement unilaterally this direct compensation. If they did, the players could strike. So the owners were in a position to kind of provoke a strike, which was their goal. But first came this joint study committee. The players were represented by Bob Boone and Sal Bando and lawyers. The owners were represented by Frank Cashin and Harry Dalton and lawyers. The players were quite earnest and sincere. The owners said, we're having financial distress as a result of free agency. Every club is in trouble. Players came to these meetings with charts showing the increase of attendance, the increase in games popularity. Didn't mean anything. The owners said, free agency is killing competitive balance. The players came with charts showing teams that signed free agents, how they moved in the standing. There was an increase in competitive balance because, as we all know, now the worst teams had a chance to sign the best players. It had never happened before. What's interesting is the owners were very publicly saying, you know, we're negotiating, we want to negotiate, and the players said they're not serious. Luckily for me, luckily I live in Cooperstown and I live near the Hall of Fame, the Hall has Harry Dalton's papers. Harry Dalton has minutes, notes from meetings that specifically show how they were engaging in unfair labor activities, where Ray Grebe, the negotiator, was saying, we will not negotiate. We will pretend that our direct compensation has been settled on, it is agreed upon. If they want to strike, let them strike. So the owners were in the position to actually make a strike happen. Grebe, as I said, was brought in by the owners in 1978 from GE, which was a kind of notorious union-busting company. The owners wanted a more professional labor negotiator, and they brought in Grebe, but he had a kind of mess on his hands with the owners. You know, the owners always think the players are disunified, but the owners were then 26 people with very different agendas and very different outlooks on things. So the joint study committee was doomed to failure, and it failed, which led to the owners implementing unilaterally their free agent compensation plan, and 6 days later, the players voting to strike at the end of May. That began the negotiating sessions in earnest to try to prevent a strike. But in looking at Bowie Kuhn's papers and looking at negotiators' papers, I spent a full day with Ray Grebe at his house several years ago. All of the inside information was the owners were not negotiating. They wanted a strike, and Kuhn's own copy of the 1980 collective bargaining agreement, he has notes on the side referring to the one bite theory, saying the players want, you know, we want them to strike in 81. The other thing the owners did was they got $50 million in strike insurance for 1981 alone. Interestingly, Lloyd's of London, which we probably all grew up thinking was like a real insurance company, it was kind of like a betting business in a sense. They ended up underwriting $50 million of insurance with some other people as part of it. After that contract was signed, they realized that the owners who took out the strike insurance could make the strike happen. But Lloyd's ended up kind of strong-arming its partner, saying, look, we're in it, let's stick to it. So the sessions were very difficult. There was a high level of mistrust. Murray Chass of the New York Times said, you know, and thinking back to what I was saying about the Joint Study Committee, Murray Chass said the players and the union never lied to him, the owners and the commissioner always did. So it was kind of somewhat futile. What was happening was the owners were saying publicly that they were in financial distress. Legally speaking, they thought they were walking a very solid line. If the owners said they were losing money, but Grebe as the negotiator never said it at the negotiating table, it wasn't really a factor. The National Labor Relations Board took the player's side to seek an injunction saying, Ray Grebe is just an agent of the owners. If every single owner is saying we're losing money, he can't disavow it. He only represents their case. So you had this weird situation where the Players Union and the National Labor Relations Board are seeking an injunction, which would have prevented a strike, and the owners are fighting the injunction to make a strike happen. In the midst of all this is Bowie Kuhn. I'll explain what this is all about. Bowie Kuhn made a speech at the 1980 winter meetings talking about the problems of free agency. Competitive balance was being ruined, and salaries were exploding and hurting the game. But the official line of the owners' negotiators was, free agency compensation is not a financial issue, which all you have to do is actually look up the definition of compensation, and it is a financial issue. But because Kuhn had been saying what a lot of owners had said, but the negotiating team had to distance themselves from him and disavow him, Kuhn was prepared the night before he went to Rochester for the hearing, and he had these notes that one of the MLB counsel had kind of instructed him on. This is in Kuhn's papers. Kind of saying, look, when you talk about free agency, remember, competitive balance is one thing, that's okay. But high salaries and financial problems are a separate issue. Don't talk about them as part of free agency as an issue for the owners. There was a further visual distancing of Kuhn from the negotiating team. When he arrived in Rochester, they made him sit by himself, like in the corner, to show he's not really with us. We don't really know the guy. It is pretty tragic. I heard an awe out there. The judge presiding over the injunction hearing ruled in favor of the owners. He was quite a character. The transcripts from that hearing, as well as a subsequent National Labor Relations Board hearing that I'll talk about soon, are now at the Hall of Fame, if anyone is ever going to do research on that. I had acquired those transcripts. They were nowhere to be found, not in Kuhn's papers, Miller's papers, anywhere. I got them from the NLRB, and now they're at the Hall. So by denying the injunction, the strike was going to happen, and it did two days later. Now a new round of negotiations takes place. And there were a lot of problems in the mix. As I said, Grebe tried to bring a professionalism to the table. Where he came from at GE, there was management representatives representing management's case, and there was labor representatives representing labor's case. Guys from the assembly line in GE did not come in to the negotiations. That wasn't true in baseball, because the union was represented by Miller and Fear, and had four key player negotiators: Doug DeSense, Bob Boone, Mark Belanger, and Steve Rogers. But any member of the union was invited to come in, which drove Grebe crazy. He didn't like the players, he didn't feel they should be there. And it had become a problem. It was a real barrier. So there's a story about Reggie that's been told. Grebe told it to me when I spent time with him, he told it to John Hellier. It's in Hellier's great book, Lords of the Realm. And it goes like this. Grebe is reading a union proposal for clarification, which I can tell you as mayor, we actually have a couple of unions in the village. You do. You read these things out loud to make sure you understand what the other side's talking about. So Grebe's reading a proposal from the union, and Reggie bursts in. And he listens, and he says, Grebe, we're not going to take your crap anymore. And Grebe looks at Reggie and says, Reggie, this is one of your proposals. And Reggie gets very quiet, says recess, and runs out of the room. And it's a great story, right? It's a great story. But as I was doing the research, I realized it's too perfect of a story. So there's Ray Grebe, the meticulous professional negotiator. There's some dumb player who doesn't even know what he's doing there, why he's there. And it's Reggie, right? Who represents that more than Reggie? So in talking to some of the guys who were in negotiations, they said, I don't remember that. But here's what I do know, and this had never been talked about. DeSense and Belanger had been teammates with Reggie on the Orioles in 76, and they and everybody knew that Reggie was a smart guy. If you could hit him in his own self-interest, he was a very eloquent spokesman. So they brought Reggie in and said, look, the owner's free agent compensation plan will hurt free agents as they come to the market, and it'll make it difficult. And Reggie said, well, I'm going to be a free agent after this year. They don't want to do that. Yes, they do. They were also talking about not giving service time credit for the strike days. Reggie's like, well, then I won't be a free agent either. I'll lose that time. So Reggie comes to a meeting and very eloquently stands up and talks to the owners about what we all know is true. No one comes to the game to see the owners. They come to see the players. The players are what's important. He gave his deference to Marvin Miller, who really, by 1981, had revolutionized the players' working environment, let alone their salary structure. So Reggie became a really powerful spokesman for the union. As I said, there was another National Labor Relations Board hearing on unfair labor practices, and the players were clearly going to win this. It was a different judge with a different kind of outlook on things. Owners were brought to testify and were grilled, and they weren't used to being treated that way. In fact, one of the owners' lawyers said, you know, Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Griffith, they're not used to being treated this way, as if these guys were some kind of royalty. Only in baseball were those people seen as royalty, but now in a real court, without any kind of buy-in to old baseball myths of how things work, these guys really floundered. They could not present their case in a logical way. So the strike did get settled a little after 6 a.m. on July 31st. Miller came out and announced a settlement. Passions were so high, Miller would not pose with Grebe for a post-settlement photo. Grebe loved Bob Boone. He mistook Bob Boone's even temperament for some kind of sympathy. And he went up to Boone after and said, you know, Bob, you know, I really like you, and I'm sorry we were on different sides of the issue, as if somehow there was a connection there. Boone immediately went to DeCinse and said, you're not going to believe what he thinks, that, like, I'm on his side, if it was only in a different situation. Rusty Staub was also one of those players who would come in and out of the negotiations, and he hated Grebe, and at one point actually passed crossword puzzles out at a session saying, if we're going to engage in wordplay, why don't we really engage in wordplay? So Grebe, when I spent a day with Grebe, he still hated Staub. And I saw Staub last summer at a party, we were talking about it, and he was so angry just at the mention of Ray Grebe that I ended up like really apologizing to him, like, for bringing it up. Like, I didn't want to ruin his night. After the settlement was reached, Grebe went over to Staub to shake his hand, and Staub said, you're not my friend. You're not my friend. You're a liar. I'm not shaking your hand. And what ensues is this ridiculous comic scene of Rusty kind of running around a table with Grebe kind of pursuing him, trying to shake his hand. So the settlement is reached. The owners have to ratify it. They meet at O'Hare at the Hilton. And at the end of the baseball strike was the beginning of the air traffic controller strike, which we now look back at as kind of the watershed moment in American labor history. So with the backdrop of like underutilized runways, the owners are negotiating the settlement. Gussie Bush pounds the floor with his cane, startling everybody. And he goes into this rant against the owners and about how shameful they are, how they couldn't hold a candle to the O'Malley's and Wrigley's of the world, and criticized the settlement, which was a pool settlement. So all the teams, except for a handful, who said they wouldn't participate in the free agent re-entry draft, everyone had to put a player into the pool, and the team that lost the free agent could pick from the pool. So what Gussie Bush said was, when we folded in 1980 to get what was promised as compensation, we had already given up our bargaining chips for 1981. What did we end up with? If the Cubs lose a player to the Phillies through free agency, then possibly I have the honor of giving the Cubs my 27th best player. Marvelous compensation. And while the owners kind of crowed that they had new compensation for free agency, by 1985 they were begging to pull the pool out of the agreement. And Jerry Reinsdorf was telling me a story about when the White Sox picked Tom Seaver. So in January 1984, Reinsdorf and Heeman are like by the teletype machine waiting to see the unprotected players, and there's Tom Seaver. And as Reinsdorf said to me, every time I picked a player from the pool, I lost another friend. So he picked Seaver. Wilpon called and said, how could you pick my player? And Reinsdorf, of course, said, how could you leave him unprotected? The White Sox picked Tom Seaver because they lost Dennis Lamb to the Blue Jays, and they couldn't have made a trade that good. Seaver was also furious because he had just come back to the Mets in 83, and even though he had a losing record, it was quite a triumphant return to New York. But Reinsdorf calmed Seaver down by saying, what would you do if you could pick Tom Seaver? So Seaver understood that. The other thing that had to be settled was how to resume the season. The owners were given permission by the players. The players said, you figure it out, whatever you do. Lots of different plans were brought up. Resuming the season as if it had never stopped, various plans on how to do half-season titleless. They ended up coming up with an initial plan, which was if the first half winner was different from the second half winner, they would face off, but if the first half winners were the same, they would play the team with the second best record for the year. That actually presented a situation where a team could conceivably lose on purpose to make sure the same team won the two halves. But Dick Wagner, the Reds, saw his own terrible future right away. He said, look, we finished a half a game behind the Dodgers in the first half. What if we finished close behind the Astros in the second half? We wouldn't make the playoffs. And that's exactly what happened. The Reds had the best record in Major League Baseball that year and didn't make the playoffs. The Cardinals had the best record in the American League East, National League East, and didn't make the playoffs. So it was a quite inartistic and athletic bomb where the best teams didn't make the playoffs. For those of you who hate either the Yankees or the Dodgers, the idea that that was the World Series of 81 maybe rankles a little bit. But the strike was over. The first game back was August 9th for the All-Star game, and then August 10th was the first full day of baseball. Now over 60,000 people came to Veterans Stadium to see Pete Rose. Pretty sure he would get a hit to break Musial's record. There was a national TV audience. Stan was in the crowd himself. Wagering on the Big Four lottery in Pennsylvania was so high for the numbers 3631 that the state was concerned that the payout was going to be too great. Rose was accompanied, some of you remember, he would have Petey around him. So 10-year-old Pete Rose Jr. was on the on-deck circle with his father. For encouragement and to witness history. In his first at-bat, Rose singles up the middle, Gary Templeton fields the ball, bobbles it a little bit, and Rose is safe. The man in charge of fireworks at Veterans Stadium hears Bill Giles, VP of the Phillies, yell, go, 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 presses the button, fireworks explode, but Giles was screaming, no, 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 because it was clear that this might be an error, which it was. So the smoke settled, the game continued, and the second Rose hit a hard grounder to Bob Forsh, who was the starting pitcher, and was out. In his third at-bat, he was also out, and then in the eighth inning, Cardinals had brought in Mark Littell. Little Petey was kind of trying to encourage his father, you know, don't worry, if you don't get the hit today, you'll get it next time. But Pete Sr. assured him he'd be fine. So Rose singles a solid shot between short and third, and the crowd goes crazy for about 13 minutes. This time, 3,631 balloons are joyously released over the stadium in Veterans in Philadelphia. Musial comes out on the field. There's a great scene of the two of them together at first base. When the game ended, there had been a hotline set up in the Phillies clubhouse to await the call from President Reagan. But there were all these technical difficulties. 3, 4, 5 times Reagan tried to call in, and there were problems with the White House switchboard. And Rose was genuinely funny, you know, for those of us who remember the early 80s and concerns about missile launching and nuclear war, Rose was saying things like, ooh, I hope there's not a missile being launched that, you know, is causing this, or tell the president I'll get back to him, he can call me later. And everyone in the clubhouse was genuinely laughing, enjoying Pete Rose, who was at that moment on top of the baseball world. And finally, baseball was back. Thank you.
Yeah.
walk-up for that?
Do you know about that?
I don't know that story, but Dallas Green had kind of told Rulli Carpenter to vote for the split season plan because the Phillies were a lock for the playoffs. But Carpenter actually did vote against it. He was the only one of the four first half owners who voted against their own interests.
Can you briefly summarize why the owners folded at the end of the strike?
The owners are very disparate people. So even when the strike began, so Reinsdorf also told me an interesting story. So Beck is wanting to sell the White Sox to DiBartolo. MLB won't let DiBartolo buy the team because he had gambling interests, and you know, somehow, unlike the Galbraiths, who were, you know, horse racing family in Pittsburgh, or Steinbrenner, who owned a racetrack in Florida, somehow the DiBartolo gambling was a problem. So Reinsdorf and Einhorn come on the scene. They're going to buy the White Sox. Reinsdorf asked around, saying, look, if we're going to buy this team, is there a chance there's going to be a strike here? And what he was told by the owners was, there's no way. But what the owners were saying was, there's no way the players would strike over such a minor issue. It was just a misread of the situation. There was no way the players were not going to strike over this issue if the owners implemented it. So early on, you had two or three owners who were not automatically in favor of provoking a strike. Edward Bennett Williams in Baltimore, Eddie Giles in Texas, and depending on his mood of the day, George Steinbrenner. As the talks devolved and were rancorous, and then for periods they didn't meet at all, more and more owners started coming to that side saying, this is crazy, Grebe's not representing my interests. And Grebe was known for kind of telling the hardliners one set of stories and the moderates another set of stories, just to keep everyone at bay. There was a growing disgust with Kuhn, even though he really was kind of somewhat tangential but connected to the negotiating. As the strike went on and various owners were losing money, although it was abetted by the strike insurance, they were just disgusted that this wasn't moving forward. So there was dissension at the beginning, and it just grew and grew as the summer went on. Well, thank you all for coming.